of all the things I've done. And I know that it's only just begun. Those smiling faces, you know, I just can't forget them. But I love you. When I think of all the things I've seen, and I know that it's only the beginning. You know those smiling faces, I just can't forget them. But for now, I love. Just for a little while, oh, just to see you smile, just for a little while. I think of all the things I've done, and I know that it's only just begun. All those smiling faces, Jesus, you know I can't forget them. For now, I love you. Right this minute, baby, I love you. Oh, my kid, I love you. At least for now, I love you.
Sorry, Cuneiform Tabs. This is Ivy by Cuneiform Tabs. We heard Simon Joyner and the Nervous Stars covering Lou Reed's I Love You. Orion Music Workshop doing Le Secret des Hommes Complices. We heard Yashlik doing Gozel. Pigeons did Behind the Reeds, DJ Female Convict Scorpion with Jonathan Richmond, Gang of Four, Otis Redding. Rodelius, Hans-Joachim Rodelius doing Weilchen Wurzeln. And Darius Denominator at the top of the set with Anesthetic Machine. My name's Scott. I look forward to seeing you next week right here on Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, worldwide online at WFMU.org. Stay tuned for Mark Hurst. Tectonic is next. Bye.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst, I'll be your host for the next hour. Thanks so much for joining. I've got a great interview to share with you today. We're going to be speaking with Glenn Adamson, who's the author of a book called A Century of Tomorrows, How Imagining the Future Shapes the Present, published by Bloomsbury. And I just want to say, before I run this interview, a couple of words about imagining the future, because it's an interesting concept when you think about it. I remember back when I was optimistic about the future as relating to technology and how tech platforms and tech gadgets and new technology of all types we're bound to improve our lives in different ways. This was a while ago, obviously. And in recent years, that optimism that I used to share with many people of my cohort, that has changed. You could say it has curdled into a kind of, I wouldn't say pessimism, I'd call it realism, but resignation I'm trying to avoid, but it is, the optimism has certainly changed. My conception of the future, as technology relates to it, has totally changed, and that has to do with various factors that I've talked about on the show. But what I want to point out is that as the years go by, our conception of the future can vary, and it can vary wildly depending on the politics and the economy and the various environmental factors that surround us. And I mean, some people could say, well, I remember back in the 60s, I was waiting for the Jetsons future. You know, I thought we would have jetpacks and robot butlers. And I think everybody has some version of the future that they were anticipating when they are younger. I don't think anyone anticipated that five companies would own the world and force everyone to use exploitative platforms. That wasn't, as they say, on anyone's bingo card, I don't think. But yet here we are. So if we think about this idea of different conceptions of the future, we can go way back. It turns out that people have been thinking about the future in different ways for a long time. And sometimes that means they were predicting the future or trying to predict the future. Sometimes they weren't trying to predict it. They were just trying to get ready for the future, whatever it might hold. And in different eras, they might have been totally uncertain as to what the future might hold. And that's a different relationship with the future, isn't it? Just acknowledging the raw uncertainty of it. Well, that brings me to Glenn Adamson's book. It's called A Century of Tomorrows. And in this book, Adamson is walking us through, as you'll hear in the interview, the last 100-plus years. He has a focus on American history, but there's some global import to this as well. Different eras in which people thought about the future in distinctly different ways. And the way Glenn explains this is by using metaphors, by focusing on organizing ideas or paradigms that people used in different eras. For example, you're going to hear in the interview, in one era, the metaphor for the future was the machine, you know, as though we can construct this complicated machine that will, with the right inputs, that will generate the correct beneficial outputs to us. And then it turned out that the machine was not a reliable or accurate descriptor of how the future worked. And then it shifted to another metaphor, the garden. Maybe it's something that needs to be tended and to grow up organically. So I want you to listen for those as we go through this interview, the various metaphors that people used across the last 100-plus years to think about the future. And those are the organizing ideas of the chapters throughout the book. So you're getting a nice summary of the book and some of the stories and anecdotes that Glenn tells. I really enjoyed the book. If you'd like to get a link to the book and some more resources, you can find it all on the playlist. The playlist is at the Tectonic website, which is tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. And just click the playlist link for the Glenn Adamson episode. Let's go ahead now and listen to my interview with Glenn Adamson, author of A Century of Tomorrows, here on Tectonic. Glenn Adamson, welcome to Tectonic.
Thank you very much, Mark. Great to be here.
Let's talk about your book, A Century of Tomorrows. This is giving us a look back at how people, in different ways over the years, have thought about the future. Now, as you point out in the introduction, this goes way back in human history when people would try to predict the future, whether with oracle bones in China or the Oracle of Delphi in ancient Greece. this book's focus is much more contemporary, mostly focusing on the last 150 or so years. Why is it important for us to look back across this span of time and examine how people have thought about the future?
Yeah, that's right. I guess when I decided to call it A Century of Tomorrows, the century I was really thinking about is the 20th century, but there's a little bit, how did we get there, and a little bit, what's happened since. And the special thing about that century, when it comes to what I call futurology, which is to say professional prediction of the future, is that it's really after the point where religion has a secure grip on that aspect of the human imagination. So it's when you start to see industries and insurance companies and fashion forecasters and designers and architects start to exert their own claims on the future, really in an area that previously had been the province of priests and mystics. So it's no longer astrology or your priest telling you what the fate of your soul is. It's instead what's going to happen in the stock market. What should the urban planning trajectory of our city be? So it starts to become professionalized, specialized, and fragmented, and therefore extremely fascinating.
And interestingly enough, your first chapter is called Heaven and Hell. You talk about a traveling evangelist named Billy Sunday, who would give these fiery sermons about hellfire and damnation to huge crowds that would gather in these revival tents wherever he would travel. And that drew what you write was the sneering condemnation from leftists like Eugene Debs, who was prominent at that time. And in some ways, we can still see that left-right split in our culture today.
Well, yeah, and spoiler alert, really what I'm saying in the book is that we've returned to this heaven and hell framework. So big picture, the argument would be that there's a holdover from earlier times when you think about the way that prediction worked in the early 20th century, in that it tends to gather around the extremes. So it's either heaven or hell, it's utopia or dystopia. And you have people like Billy Sunday, fascinating character, who would show up in town, who would actually build those revival structures in which he was preaching, cover the floor with sawdust, you know, shout without amplification for over an hour, and people would be overcome. And then crucially at the end, he would take financial donations, which is one of the reasons he got so much sneering condemnation. But, you know, his storyline is absolutely the evangelical, listen to me or you're going to perdition, right? So very much a religious framework. And it's interesting that you can also look at other kinds of professional predictors of things in the early 20th century, and they have exactly the same shtick. Marcus Garvey would be a great example, the great founder of Black nationalism. But, you know, what happens, at least in my mind, is that over the course of the 20th century, that kind of extremism really gets drummed out of professional futurology by these improved, supposedly improved techniques. But then towards the end of the 20th century, as we'll get to, no doubt, you have a kind of return of this extremism. And that's sort of where we've landed today.
Yeah. I mean, if you had asked me, I don't know, even 10 years ago, do I think the culture resembles that of Billy Sunday and Eugene Debs? I would say, no, not really. I mean, those elements are still present. They have their place. But we have a pretty decent consensus around secular modes of conversation and even talking about the future. And now just in the last couple of years, I mean, especially in the last few months, we're seeing much greater incidence of what I would call Christian nationalism at the very top levels of the American government led by the current occupant in a way that I don't know that we've seen in about 100 years.
Right. I would agree with that. I think also it's fascinating to think about Trump as emerging precisely from the moment where I see a crisis around confidence in the future happening. So in the 1980s, you have this episode often called postmodernism, where the kind of security and certainty and, as I say, confidence that companies and professional experts of all kinds, frankly, have in laying claim to stories about the future, that starts to be very broadly challenged. You start to have this kind of breakdown of the consensus that you're describing. And obviously being very kind of simplistic here, but then fast forward another 30, 40 years, and you have a real crisis in politics because of the drastic decline of faith in expertise itself. And of course, the most important kind of expertise is what's going to happen to us. And if you don't feel like you can believe anyone when they try to give you an answer to that question, whether it's coming from the medical establishment or coming from a company or coming from your local school, whatever that authority used to be, what do you have in its place? Well, generally speaking, you have conservative reaction or you have a kind of nihilism, which is how I would describe the current state of power in the United States, a combination of reaction and nihilism.
And it's interesting, as you said, with Billy Sunday and Eugene Debs, and you named some other actors as well at that time, everyone has a pretty dim view of the future. One thing that Debs and Sunday can agree on is that we're going in the wrong direction. Everything is awful, which is a parallel to today, as we're pointing out. Everyone seems to be anxious about the future. But there was another parallel between that early moment about 100 years ago and today that I found very interesting. And that was that there was an opposing view. There was a view of relentless optimism and hype that came from advertisers who were blanketing the media with these promises about, get ready for it, new technology. Sound familiar? And you talk about ads for a Western electric vacuum cleaner that's going to make everything better and the unlimited power of Regal motor cars. It sounds just like the tech hype that we're hearing today.
Exactly. And of course, that was not lost on me when I was writing about that. Of course, from a futurological point of view, what's interesting is that you then get the generation of these professions out of that. So there's the advertising profession, but you also get something like industrial design. So these figures that emerge in the 1920s and 1930s who start to streamline everything. And as I always like to say, a streamlined object, whether it's a train or a toaster, has these contours that make it look like it's going to arrive into the future a little bit sooner than everything else, right? That's the visual rhetoric of it. And you could say exactly the same thing about an iPhone, frankly, that it's presented to you as if it's a little chunk of the future that's arrived in your present and you have access to it if you pay for it, right? So this idea of famous line often attributed to William Gibson, the science fiction writer, that the future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed. And if you think of that in terms of class and think of it in terms of access, then what you can say is that that uneven distribution of the future is something that companies and individual designers and experts can exploit and say, I'm the one that's going to be able to give you that access. So that's where you get the formation of these futurological professions that are really built around narratives of optimism rather than narratives of disaster.
That's right. And these companies will dangle the latest upgrade of the iPhone or whatever the surveillance brick is and say, you should aspire to owning one of these. Just work a little harder or even go into more debt and hand us the money so you can have it.
And in fact, they even develop a theory of that. So it's not just the product, but it's also the conceptualization of how the relationship between the present and the future is going to work in a corporate context. And that, of course, is the theory of planned obsolescence. So you have this kind of glide path that's designed and constructed in advance where those products are going to roll out. So in other words, a company in the 19-teens probably had very little sense of what it would have made in 5 years. A company in the 1930s, like the auto manufacturers in Detroit who really originate this idea, they have a pretty good sense. And of course, now Apple has an absolutely 100% lock on what they're going to be selling us in 3 years. And that's where futurology starts to become systematized, starts to become bureaucratic, starts to become capitalized to a much higher level. In other words, the present becomes more and more captured by the future.
And that's when we reach the age of the machine, as you put it, the machine becomes a widespread metaphor for futurology of that time. It's systematized, as you said. And you write about the auto industry, as you said, that pioneered this idea of planning out changed products in the future. And then you talk about color forecasters. That was fascinating, that there were people whose job it was just to decide what the series of colors was going to be in upcoming products.
Right. And they were actually very influential on the auto manufacturers. And it's interesting here also to note the gender divide, because you won't be surprised to hear that the industrial designers and the auto guys were guys, whereas the color forecasters were women. The most famous is Margaret Hayden Rourke. And this is another thing about the future not being evenly distributed, because actually what they were doing was basically industrial espionage, where they were sending spies over to France, which of course is where fashion came from, right, in the 1930s. And they were getting the first reports. And so then they would tell wallpaper manufacturers or whoever it was, what are the coming colors going to be? And they would take those cues from the Parisian salons. So that's a great example of one of these new futurological professions.
And then in terms of works of art or popular culture that reflect this metaphor of the machine, you talk about Fritz Lang's Metropolis, Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times, Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, and one of my favorites, this is a nonfiction book, Technics and Civilization from 1934. All of these were from, well, Metropolis was 27, Modern Times 36, Brave New World 32, Technics and Civilization 34. So there's this ferment of machine thinking, I guess we could call it. And Technics and Civilization was written by Lewis Mumford, who I have talked about a lot over the years on this show. And I was happy to find that this was but the first mention of Mumford in your book. He comes up again and again and again throughout the rest of the book. Tell us about the significance of Technics and Civilization that really turbocharged Lewis Mumford's career.
That's a good word for it. I'm really glad that you've thought about Lewis Mumford before, because I feel like he's not a very well-remembered figure now, but he was so famous then. He was the definition of the public intellectual,
right,
in the middle of the 20th century. And he, of course, has his own trajectory, and I found it very useful, I guess, as a writer to return to him in successive chapters and check in with his thinking as it developed. But in the 1930s, he's, I think you could say, in a relatively optimistic mode. He's about to become very influential on the World's Fair of 1939. Maybe we can get back to that. But he writes this amazing book, Technics and Civilization, which really pins down exactly the thing that I think is so interesting about the machine as a metaphor for the future, which is that the machine doesn't care about us. Once it's constructed, and assuming it's given enough fuel and maintenance, it just goes. So if you can build a future like that, then it sort of factors out human error and psychology, and it achieves something like a maximum efficiency state. And Mumford is both attracted and terrified by this idea. It's worth noting that, of course, this is in the wake of the Russian Revolution also. So people like Mumford are spending a lot of time thinking about what's happening in these centrally planned economies, which often frame themselves as being like machines. And so the argument that he makes in Technics and Civilization, which really is an argument about technology as a driver of human affairs, like the master cause of everything else, the argument that he makes is that we're stuck with the machine, so we have to learn how to adapt ourselves to it, almost like a kind of Darwinian argument. Another theme that comes up a lot in my book, this question of evolution, another powerful model of the future. And he argues that human beings need to acclimate themselves to the logic of the machine rather than the other way around.
Let's pick up on that thread about Darwin for a moment. You write that in 1863, a New Zealand sheep farmer named Samuel Butler wrote a little essay called Darwin Among the Machines, which talked about how people eventually could evolve into machines. And this was a warning, not a not an aspirational outcome as it would be today for the tech bros. And then a few years later, 1872, Butler writes Erewhon, a dystopian novel or a proto science fiction novel, I guess, in which, quote, the people who live there have long ago declared war on machines and done away with them, lest they reproduce themselves and become ascendant. So I want listeners to think about this. There's a guy named Butler warning people against the ascendancy of machines, and in his novel, people declared war against the machines and wiped them out. What does that make you think of? It should make you think of Dune and the Butlerian Jihad.
Yeah, that's a great comparison. And in all the research I did, there was nothing more jaw-dropping than finding this writing of Samuel Butler from over 150 years ago that seems so relevant now. Just to say, Erewhon, the title, it's almost nowhere backwards. So he's responding in this very clever way to the idea of utopia, which also means no place. And amazingly, he reacts to Darwin's Origin of Species, which of course had just been published a few years earlier, by thinking in kind of pseudoscientific logic, well, if animals evolved out of plants and humans evolved out of animals, then maybe machines will evolve out of us. So we're going to be in the same position that the plants were when the monkeys came around, or the monkeys were when the humans came around, right? And this is amazing, because of course, this is exactly what we're talking about now with respect to artificial intelligence.
Exactly.
And he's already thinking, as I say, over 150 years ago now, about the prospect of a kind of techno dystopia that can only be escaped by the actual elimination of advanced technology. And this is an argument, of course, you're hearing now, that you just need to turn your computer off. That's the only way to keep away the surveillance, keep away the machine thinking, the algorithmic determinism that seems to have us in its grip. And so the fact that Butler was thinking about that so long ago just shows you that futurology is a real thing.
It's a real thing, and we haven't paid enough attention to it, given that this warning was, as you say, 150 years ago, and here we are. And then, as I brought up, Frank Herbert reminded us again by setting his civilization in the post-Butlerian Jihad universe after humans had actually wiped out all the machines. And now here we are in the 2020s in an economy dominated by tech bros who are proud to announce that we are just about to evolve into machines. I mean, it truly is. Are you familiar with the Torment Nexus idea?
No.
Oh, it's this social media post from 2021 written by someone named Alex Bleckman. It's two lines long. It goes like this. Sci-fi author. In my book, I invented the Torment Nexus as a cautionary tale. Tech company. At long last, we have created the Torment Nexus from classic sci-fi novel, Don't Create the Torment Nexus. Again and again now, we're seeing Silicon Valley take the warnings of the past and use them as blueprints for how they're going to abuse us for profit. And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with Glenn Adamson, author of the book, A Century of Tomorrows, How Imagining the Future Shapes the Present. A book that I enjoyed a lot. Really wide-ranging in its look back at the 20th century and a little before that and a little after, and the various metaphors for how different eras, people in different eras, conceived of the future. We've heard about heaven and hell and the machine. In the second half of the interview, we're going to hear some more metaphors and how it applies to where we are today in the 2020s. If you want more information on this episode of Tectonic, find the playlist at the Tectonic website at techtonic.fm. Let's go ahead now and listen to the second half of my interview with Glenn Adamson here on Tectonic. Let's talk about the 1939 World's Fair. This was an incredibly influential event. A lot of really big companies the big tech of that day, General Motors and others, put a lot of effort and money into these exhibits so that the public could experience for themselves the pitch, basically. This is the bright, shining future that American industry is building for all of us. What were some of the influential ideas that came out of the 1939 World's Fair?
Right. So here we're at peak futurology, at least in its confident modernist mode. And as we foreshadowed, Lewis Mumford is part of this story because it was actually his idea to call the World's Fair the World of Tomorrow, to give it that theme. But of course, what happened was that the money men came in and basically became a giant corporate showcase. And the most famous project within the World's Fair was the Futurama, literally called the Futurama, funded by General Motors and designed by one of the pioneer industrial designers, Norman Bel Geddes, who not coincidentally had a background in stagecraft, so theater set design. And he basically approached it as a gigantic piece of dramaturgy. He created a gigantic diorama showing the United States in 1960, because it was funded by GM. The world of 1960 turned out to be totally determined by cars and traffic and highways. And it was the car that had revolutionized America by that time. And the audience would ride on a kind of Disney World-like moving track in seats above this amazing hand-built diorama. And it was by far the most frequently visited attraction in the fair and must have been seen by, you know, upwards of, you know, millions of people saw this. And it was wildly influential and wildly beloved at the time. Of course, now we look back and it seems both like a kind of transparent piece of corporate promotion, but also as a very, very narrow and unsophisticated way of thinking about the future. So, you know, for example, there's no discussion of racial conflict. There's no discussion of pollution. Certainly that was nowhere on the world map at that time. Certainly nothing that an auto company would have been thinking about, the kind of disruptions that would happen within cities. I used to live in New Haven, Connecticut, perfect example of this, but the kind of disruptions that would happen when you rammed a highway through a city and gave it priority over neighborhoods, that was completely ignored. So now it seems very, very naive, but at the time it was incredibly captivating. And, you know, for me, we've talked a lot about the problems that we are now having because of a loss of confidence in futurology, but this is kind of the other end of the spectrum. This is futurology as kind of ironclad, self-persuaded, 100% certainty and crusading. And that is equally dangerous, you could argue.
Yeah, and anyone who knows the history of New York City will immediately think of Robert Moses jamming highways where they don't belong and splitting up neighborhoods and causing all sorts of problems. And you also bring up Jane Jacobs, who was famously the community-minded organizer and author who successfully saved Manhattan's West Village from Robert Moses' predatory highway that would have killed it. So here we are with futurology organized around this metaphor of the car. And around this time, as you say, we see the downsides of that approach. Traffic, the division of neighborhoods, pollution, inefficiency as people are driving slower and slower. And it shows that there are real problems with over-urbanizing everything. And so here comes this counter-movement, which you write about in the next chapter called Garden, in which you're writing about the Garden Cities movement. So here, city planners are saying that we should have this, as you write, a concentric series of ring-shaped districts, one for housing, the next one for schools, the next one for factories, and so on, all surrounded by a vast ring of parkland, which you write was the original greenbelt. And the goal was to harmoniously integrate the rural and the urban, combining the best of both. How did that work out?
Well, you know, you have to say, from a point of view of actual popularity, it worked out beautifully because the post-war American suburb has really evolved from that idea of the garden city. And in practice, the idea of a green belt, you know, I live in London and there's a green belt around London. And I use it all the time, and so do most other people in London. So although suburbia itself can be critiqued, and I will just add here in relation to our previous conversation, I think a lot of those critiques have to do with its overdependence on the automobile rather than public transport, which could have been, you know, the way that things had gone had it not been for the lobbying of the auto industry. But in a lot of respects, garden city thinking, I think, can be credited with a lot of the things that are good about today's urban fabric. It's also just interesting to me as a metaphor about the future. And I think of the ones that I think take up in the book, it's the one that I personally have the most sympathy with, because the idea here would be that instead of the future being like a machine that's self-propelling, the future is like a garden that needs to be tended. So it's not just nature. It's not just something that's going to happen to you and is red in tooth and claw and, again, indifferent to your welfare. Rather, it's something that you yourself have propagated and cultivated and that you need to tend carefully, but also being aware that it's somewhat unpredictable and will go its own way, as gardens do, but therefore has its own kind of beauty that you could never plan. So that's really the metaphor of the future that I'm, as I say, myself most attracted to. And I think something that we can still learn from, even though it unfolded in the 1920s and 30s, at least as I describe it in the book.
And Lewis Mumford was very influential in the Garden Cities movement.
That's right. Yeah. So he comes up again here. And in fact, another thing that he did do for the World's Fair was to make a film with Catherine Bauer, who is an important urbanist and architect of that time. And they actually lay out essentially a Garden City's vision of what the future could look like. And unfortunately for them, they don't have big corporate money behind it. So everyone's going to the Norman Belgetti's Futurama and they're not seeing this film. But the film was a much more intelligent prescription of what could be built in America at that time.
Yeah, this was a half-hour documentary called The City. And you write, Mumford warned that the machine must be kept at bay so that the ways of the countryside can be made safe. Who can disagree with that today? And yet, as always, the big corporate money draws the crowd. And so everyone rides their ride in Futurama, which, by the way, I just wanted to add as a side note, that might today seem a little naive that there was a ride showing a corporate vision of the future. But I remember 40 some odd years after 1939, this is the early 1980s, my family and I, when I was a kid, went to Orlando, Florida, right after the opening of Disney's Epcot Center. And in the center, and you write about Epcot, in the center of Epcot is this spherical structure that I think was inspired by the geodesic dome that was invented by Buckminster Fuller, which is someone else you write about quite a bit. And this ride was, you get in a little seat and you ride all the way up in the spiral through the sphere, looking at various corporations' visions of the American future.
That's right. And I'm not sure that Fuller himself would have liked that very much. But, you know, Epcot stands for Experimental City of Tomorrow, right? So it's exactly in the mold of the 1939 World's Fair. And it's something that Disney Corporation is laying claim to, as well as Buckminster Fuller's credibility as a futurologist. And I think we might just reflect on the fact that although that track of observation and the Futurama or the Epcot people conveyor may seem naive to us, in a way, social media is just the distribution of that same logic through the mechanism of our phones, right? That's what a feed is, effectively. It's exactly the same logic, but brought to you through your own device rather than you being jammed into a building. So it's become metastasized.
Well put. Why go to the trouble of building a ride that requires maintenance? Instead, just beam out your corporate propaganda to people's surveillance devices that they willingly sit there and watch for hours on end.
I mean, Instagram literally has what they call carousels, right, of images.
I never thought of that.
It's not very well disguised.
All right, so we've got Mumford tirelessly advocating for garden cities. It has some influence, as you say, but things continue to change. And the next chapter is called Lab, in which the metaphor is the laboratory where futurologists, we're talking now 1960s, 1970s maybe, intend to conduct experiments using technology in order to attempt to predict the future, but also to build the future to their own benefit. And one person you focus on in this chapter is Robert McNamara, who you write did as much as anyone to push America into Vietnam and was also involved in the introduction of computing into government policy.
So he's coming out of Harvard, and then he becomes highly placed, and then eventually the president briefly of Ford Motor Company. And so he's very important in taking a wartime logic of systematized planning and forecasting into the corporate sector and then into the government. And then he, as you say, helps lead us into Vietnam and really encourages that escalation. And I would say if you were going to pinpoint any moment where futurology begins to run into a wall, it's really the Vietnam War, because all of these people, McNamara being almost the poster boy version of this, but there were many others, including at the Rand Corporation, for example, and across the government, all these experts that had been trusted and had been assuring us that they knew what was going to happen led this country into this quagmire of unbelievably tragic proportions to absolutely no benefit to anyone. And suddenly it was like a wake-up call. We can't believe these people anymore. Then obviously you have Nixon, you have Watergate, and everything unspools from there. And in a way, here we are. Obviously more complicated than that. You have some back and forth since then. But it's really with the collapse of faith in this, what I'm calling the laboratory model of the future, that you really start to get into the radical disestablishment, you know, the lack of credibility for futurology. So it might be worth saying just a little bit more about what that lab model is. So again, thinking here about metaphors, we had the machine, we had the garden. The idea of the lab is that you would test out various futures and set them side by side, just as you would in Petri dishes, if you're a chemist. So you test them by running models. Of course, computers are very important here. The idea that you would be able to assign quantitative values to different aspects of the future. Again, a very corporate idea, but not only, right? It could be framed in terms of sociology, for example, urban planning, and that you would study it intently, and that this becomes like a science. That's really the key idea here. And in the 1950s, and even through most of the 60s, this is an idea that is absolutely accepted across a wide range of sectors. So it does, as I say, run into the wall in the war in the late 60s, and you have the rise of the counterculture in response to that. But there's a good 20 years there almost when it is the dominant model of futurology.
And as you say, the catastrophe in Vietnam led to the partial or full abandonment of the lab model, as we then embraced a new metaphor for the future, which you write is party. You're using that word in a couple of different senses. But you're covering the counterculture, which you write the counterculture's contribution of futurology was the principle of transformation. Completely opposing the idea of the future as a laboratory, the hippies wanted to decenter the individual in favor of the collective. And I guess we could add, then the collective would transform the world.
Exactly. So, you know, if the lab is a kind of extension of the machine thinking of the 1920s and 30s, for me, the counterculture embrace of the party, hedonism, drug culture, music, all those things, that's to some extent an extension of the garden thinking of the 1930s. But to get into that a little bit more deeply, I guess the way I look at it is that the counterculture, which, by the way, is only a relatively small phenomenon. You're talking about less than 1% of the population who are actually involved in the counterculture, right? But it in our imaginations, even at the time it was like this, it's the defining thing that's happening in terms of the entertainment industry, in terms of clothing, in terms of, obviously, the embrace of drugs, et cetera, sexual revolution. So it's very, very influential, despite the small amount of actual commune dwellers that there are. And their idea about the future is that you need to allow it to happen on its own through this kind of ecstatic embrace of the present. So instead of trying to control it, which is what the people in the lab are doing, instead what you do is to create the circumstances in which the future will arise in this kind of organic, unforced, beautiful way. And if you think about hippie language and lyrics, it's all about that, right? So
go with the flow.
go with the flow, right? Excuse me while I kiss the sky. Pick your favorite song from the late 60s and it's going to have something about this in it. The idea here would be that the party as a master metaphor is about gathering together and losing yourself in the moment. Again, drugs would be a good example of this. You take LSD, you're in an altered state, and time itself seems to expand and become elastic. So your whole relationship to temporality, in fact, changes. So that linear relationship that you have always had, particularly if you're raised in post-war America, instead what you have is this three-dimensional relationship to the future, which is exploratory, which is gratifying, which is pleasure-giving, and which ultimately transcends the now, as well as kind of exploding in the now, the exploding plastic inevitable, as Warhol's crew had it. And that, again, is a very attractive model of the future, but I think it also has a lot of problems, which you probably will immediately occur to the listener, because it's not very applicable to the practicalities of life. And the counterculture itself was often very self-destructive. You know, there's a hilarious, to me, hilarious little thread that I talk about in the book where I explore the hippies' relationship to money, where they're simultaneously trying to abolish the cash economy and exist entirely in terms of gifts and barter, but they're also panhandling out on the street, right? So, you know, this kind of the contradictions of the counterculture run deep. But again, there's a lot of truth to what they're saying, and particularly as a reaction to the corporatized capitalist version of the future that's being peddled to them when they're kids, you can easily understand how they came to those positions.
And the counterculture laid the groundwork for one of the early points of view about the internet, which was that we should build this World Wide Web where everyone has a voice and collectively we can build this better future online. And I'm intimately familiar with that worldview because that was mine when I was a young man just starting out. And it obviously has not turned out that way. It shows you the value of predicting the future or even earnestly trying to create the future. And that pretty much brings us to present day. I'm not going to get into the last chapter, which is called Flood. Listeners are going to have to read the book for themselves to see how the high anxiety of our moment due to the data glut stemmed from this transition into this new metaphor and what people and organizations are trying to do still to chart a path forward in increasingly anxious and uncertain times. But I just want to ask you one last question, Glenn, and that's how you're feeling about the future. Because you seem to be optimistic. You write in your conclusion that to believe that the future is a lost cause can only lead us to very dark places. We owe the future all the enthusiasm and imagination we can summon in ourselves. Is that how you feel, that we need to go in with our best effort, even as dark and uncertain as these times are?
Yeah, in a way, that has to be the answer, because what's the alternative? You know, well, I guess we're seeing the alternative all around us, right? A kind of an increase in attempts to control the future, which are necessarily going to be narrow and self-defeating. And then, as I said, this kind of reactionary impulse to slam the door in the future's face, you know, build the wall. Having said that, I can also understand why so many people feel like they're drowning after the flood. You know, the idea of the flood is that we have this information overload and it becomes impossible to predict or navigate the future because it's too multivariable or just too complex to contemplate. And so the reaction to that often is to feel overwhelmed and to shut down. And I guess the big takeaway for me from the book is that we have to do better than that, and that we have to generate new models of futurology, however imperfect and however informed by their own necessary uncertainty, that are not exploitative and are not attempts to move problems off of our own plate and onto somebody else's, which is where a lot of futurological activity, frankly, is generated now. And I hope that the book that I've written gives you, well, literally a century of tomorrow is a century worth of futurological thinking that you can draw from and learn from in order to craft a new way of thinking about the future. I'm a historian, not a futurologist. So in a way, I don't feel like it's my job, if I could put it that way, to say what's going to happen, or even necessarily how we should think about it. But the lesson that I would draw from having done all this research and writing is that avoiding extremism, the kind of heaven and hell model, and thinking in terms of these more productive ideas, the machine, the garden, the lab, the party, all productive and generative in their own way, and trying to find the DNA of our futurology in those earlier examples, at least it seems to me very promising.
The book is called A Century of Tomorrows. I would actually call it A Century and a Half of Tomorrows, but that's just a detail. A Century of Tomorrows, How Imagining the Future Shapes the Present, by you, Glenn Adamson. Great job on the book, Glenn, and thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Mark. I really appreciate it.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host, and will remain so for the remaining several minutes of the show. We just heard my interview with Glenn Adamson, author of the book A Century of Tomorrows, How Imagining the Future Shapes the Present, published by Bloomsbury. I like this book a lot. I learned a lot. There were some really interesting characters, you know, from Billy Sunday on. Several of the people featured in the book I simply hadn't heard of. And of course, there were others who I had heard of and were happy to see them included, such as Lewis Mumford. And I have put on the playlist, if you're interested in more on Lewis Mumford, I covered on the September 19, 2022 episode, so this is now 3 years ago, I had an interview with Aaron Sachs, who wrote a book called Up From the Depths, Herman Melville, Lewis Mumford, and Rediscovery in Dark Times. That's from Princeton University Press, and that went deeper into Lewis Mumford's life. It was a dual biography of Mumford and Melville and the parallels between those two. Listen, go back in the archives at tectonic.fm, find that episode from 2022 with Aaron Sachs and listen to that. And that plus this interview with Glenn Adamson, I think, will give you a good sense of Lewis Mumford. And again, you can find that at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. So thanks again to Glenn Adamson for coming on the show and sharing his thoughts about the book. Well done. I wanted to finish with my thoughts about where we are now as we're in the mid-2020s, and perhaps we have a different conception of the future now that we see the ravages of the big tech beasts predating on all of us. And I happened to come across an article, an essay really, in Wired Magazine that I thought expressed well, or set up really effectively, a new idea perhaps for a new metaphor that I'd like to propose. And I know that Glenn in his book, A Century of Tomorrows, mentions the flood as his final metaphor, as we talked about. And I like that. But just for fun, I'm gonna suggest a new metaphor for where we are now. Let me read you a little bit of this essay. And I should say, this essay was written by a past Tectonic guest, Stephen Levy, who is a veteran technology reporter, journalist, author of several books, who's done great work. He's been on the show twice over the years. And this piece is called I Thought I Knew Silicon Valley, I Was Wrong. And it's linked on the playlist, which you can find at tectonic.fm. Let me read you just a short excerpt from Levy's essay about thinking he knew Silicon Valley, but saying he was wrong. It's really about his disillusionment around Silicon Valley that he says has appeared relatively recently. Here's what Levy writes. Ever since Steve Jobs began selling the first sleek Apple IIs,
digital technology has been touted as America's pride and future. In its own geeky way, tech spoke truth to power. But now, says Stanford professor of social ethics of science and technology, Rob Reich, quote, an extraordinarily tiny number of billionaires who control the information ecosystem have made allyship with the most consequential and fearsome political power in the world. There has never been a time in history when those things have been combined. And that's the end of the quote of this professor, Rob Reich, as brought to us by Stephen Levy in this essay called I Thought I Knew Silicon Valley, I Was Wrong. Basically, what Levy is saying, why he's drawing on this quote from Stanford's Rob Reich, is to say, I thought that technology was going to be a force for good. Levy is basically echoing what I said at the beginning of this episode. In a past era, I felt optimistic about tech. But now what we see is extremely, exceedingly dangerous to all of us. And Rob Reich put his finger on it. The danger to us is the new allyship between big tech, the consolidated power and wealth of big tech, with governmental power, with state power. That's happening in the U.S. and not just here, it's happening in countries around the world. It's this new consolidation of tech plus state power. And so that brings up the question of, well, what are we going to call this new metaphor? Glenn Adamson, as I said, finished his book with Flood. I'd like to propose a new metaphor, which I'm going to call blob. For lack of a better term, what I'm seeing as the defining metaphor for our near future, it's the blob. It's the growing, metastasizing cooperation between big tech billionaires and the current occupant of the White House and other state power around the world. It's not just this one individual, other state power around the world, the combination of incredible power, wealth, influence, the control they are able to enjoy due to their surveillance systems that impact all of us every day, all of that combined with the desires of the state. And as we're seeing a rise of authoritarianism and anti-democratic sentiment all over the world right now, it is very dangerous for us. So we're entering into some disturbing times, I'm afraid. And I would like to think that the blob is the metaphor that we can talk about, we can discuss, and maybe if we are lucky, we can come up with some beginnings of ideas towards a solution that will bring us something better than the oppression and the surveillance and control and predation that faces us due to the growth at any cost, metastasizing power of big tech and its governmental allies. That's about all the time I have today. You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Stay tuned for Dave Mandel. If you would like to reach out to me, you can reach me at a new email address, mark@tectonic.fm. That's mark@tectonic.fm. Give me your ideas, your comments, suggestions, what have you. And until next time, friends, I have one more suggestion for you, and that is to do the following. Avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, friends, get off Google. And in coming up with an outro, an idea for an outro, I had to think, what would be a good song that brings us back to the idea of looking back to the past and thinking back to better days? And I have found just the song, friends. It is the great Hot 8 Brass Band with the song Remember the Time. Enjoy, friends, and I'll see you next time.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another exciting installment of It's Complicated, an hour of prog and prog-adjacent music. This show comes to you every Monday at this time, 7 p.m. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. Pleasure to be here, always. And while I update the online playlist, give me a second. We're going to start tonight's show with some music from London. I forgot what we were going to start. We're going to start with a group called Lead Bib, B-I-B. Recent group. I would say this band is kind of jazzy, a jazz group, I would probably call them, if pressed. But definitely proggy. They monkey around with time signatures, something we like around here. And this is going to be a track from, as soon as I find it, track from an album called Sizewell T, Lead Bib, with the tune Chalky Bib.